It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pittsburgh's Gender Equity Commission recently launched a new workforce equity initiative to address the persistent gender pay gap, which means women could have less upward mobility in their work. Has the pandemic exacerbated that disparity? The executive director of the Gender Equity Commission joins us now. Anu Pamajan, welcome to The Confluence.
Thank you. I'm glad to be chatting with you.
According to the 2018 American Community Survey data, for each dollar a white man makes, white women make 79 cents, black women make 62 cents, and Latinas make 54 cents. Your reports, your data shows that that gap is even wider here in Pittsburgh, especially for women of color.
It's unfortunately true. And so in Pittsburgh, black women's median earnings ends up being 54 cents to a white man's median earning of a dollar. Mm-hmm. And that means that in 2020, if you take a hypothetical black woman, she would have to work till November 6, 2020 to catch up for the same work to a white man's earning for 2019. So it takes almost another entire year.
Your study, your analysis, has it taken into account the pandemic?
The Gender Equity Commission in September of 2019 released the report, I call it the PIGR report for short, Pittsburgh's Inequality Across Gender and Race. Then in March, of course, the pandemic changed all of our lives. And we've been very carefully tracking what has been happening in terms of the gap. So our PIGR report showed us there are health inequalities and education inequalities, but because we're located in city government, we're focused on what city government has the ability to change, and that is high rates of poverty, especially for black women and children, and they're higher than in comparable cities. So we know racism and sexism are national problems, not Pittsburgh problems, but we have our own specific patterns. The areas in which we could make a dent are in the areas of poverty and in workforce. The history of existing gender inequalities is, for a lot of reasons, just increasing. So partly related to the wage gap, and because of it, women already earn less, which means they have fewer savings. Mm-hmm. So, of course, everyone is being affected by the pandemic. But when you look at it with a gender lens, you see that women start off with less money.
Mm-hmm. The Gender Equity Commission has suggested a three-pronged approach to shrink the pay gap: training, negotiating a fair salary and benefits, and engaging local employers. How much good do you think paycheck negotiation will do during a pandemic recession? First, if people don't have jobs, and second, if they don't feel they have the power, the standing to negotiate.
My first thought is, when I think about the pandemic, I want to make sure people are safe, have access to food, aren't experiencing housing insecurity. So things like salary negotiation might seem a little less important. The salary negotiation part is what makes it especially helpful for women who, because of implicit bias, because of past practices, really do not find a level playing field in the workforce. So the salary negotiation has been shown to really help women. But the trainings in general are about empowering individuals, and they're open to everyone in the city. They're actually about how people can own their own story to feel, yes, I can ask for more. I can do research in my industry. I can find out, how to have more leverage so that employers aren't able to ask candidates for employment, how much did you make before? Okay, we're going to pay one person less than another because of their salary history. Those kinds of techniques tend to leave women even further behind. So this helps by targeting strategies that will support women. But we're especially proud because this is for all Pittsburghers, and a pandemic is a really good time to help people feel like there are new skills they can learn to upskill themselves.
Another reason cited for why women are suffering most during the pandemic recession is the shutdown of schools, daycare. For women to get ahead, what kind of changes need to be made to childcare?
So one challenge is, I think, political will and buy-in, that we have to be bold and innovative and really look ourselves in the mirror in Pittsburgh and say, we have the ability to do these things, and they're not brand new ideas. So one thing that that we're doing in the city that I'm particularly excited about, that the Gender Equity Commission recommended back in June, is to have a guaranteed income program. So we're going to be piloting that. So one thing people living in extreme poverty need, they need money. In our capitalist society, they need more than they need lots of forms to fill out and red tape and expectations or stigma that a lot of people living in poverty aren't there because they don't work hard enough or they don't have a good work ethic. In fact, they're often working multiple jobs. The more that we can get people access to resources and finances, sometimes direct cash allotments, and they can then participate in local economies, I think that now is the moment. It's too long delayed, universal child care, that women, because of inherited gender expectations, women do, you know, the vast majority of caretaking, both for younger generations and for aging populations. And so they have to make really tough choices. So they're paid less because of the gender wage gap, which is very, very well established. And then they're also doing all of this work that makes our societies run.
Anu, a University of Pittsburgh report from 2019 shows Black women and men in other cities have better health, income, employment, and educational outcomes than Pittsburgh's Black residents. So is the issue deeper than how much is in that paycheck?
I think there are a lot of intersecting issues. I think you may hear sometimes people say, it's not about race, it's about socioeconomics, it's about class. I think the answers are, it's about both and more. I think it's about who has been making policy, making decisions, and for whom. What we've had in the United States for a long time is a retrenching from social safety nets, social services, and in Pittsburgh, we're very lucky because we have such a strong nonprofit community, but they can't bear the weight of a society that is sharing resources, frankly, hoarding resources for a very small group of people, and disinvesting from neighborhoods that are, for example, primarily Black. So it is absolutely goes beyond just the paycheck. It goes to social norms, biases and stereotypes, and who's at the table.
So finally, does addressing the differential require more than just pay raises for women? Does it need a change in mindset, a change in attitude, change in culture?
It absolutely does. This is me speaking sort of more in terms of my personal practice. I used to be an academic, and one of the ways you're trained is to publish is really to make the best possible argument and be the smartest person in the room or seem like it. And what I've really been practicing the last several years is the idea of cultural humility. And I think it's really important for leaders to be not just willing, but to embrace saying, I don't know the answer to this. When leadership plows ahead and says, I got the perfect solution, this is how we're going to solve the problem for poor people, but it's someone who's not in that experience and doesn't know the specifics, the solutions are often awful. They really don't meet the needs of people who have been systematically disadvantaged because of race and gender. And so really starting with a perspective that says, we can't make top-down decisions and expect anything will be different than that our solutions will benefit the people on the top. I mean, that seems like pretty obvious to me that if only a select group is making decisions for everyone's good, they're really going to only support their own good.
Anu Pamajan is the executive director of the Gender Equity Commission of the City of Pittsburgh. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. When Pennsylvania's Abandoned and Blighted Property Conservatorship Act became law in 2008, it was intended to help nonprofits and neighbors address blighted and abandoned properties and bring them up to code. But in the dozen years since, some property owners and neighborhood advocates have criticized the law and private developers that seemingly take advantage of it to build their Pittsburgh area portfolios. Rich Lord is an economic development reporter for a public source. Rich, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
And WESA's Katie Amorisi covers the impact of COVID-19 on the economy for 90.5. Good morning, Kate.
Good morning.
Kate, let's start with you. When you were at the Post-Gazette, you wrote a series of articles about Pennsylvania's conservatorship law. So how did it come about and what was its intended purpose?
Yes, Kevin. So I started looking into this issue last year because there were a couple cases that came to my attention, including one case in particular where a family almost lost their home. Some attorneys and property owners were questioning if these were the type of cases that the law was really supposed to be addressing. Now, on the other hand, there are a lot of neighborhood and community groups that said the law was very helpful and that say this law is needed because it's a good way to combat blight and to, you know, clean up vacant properties. You know, in particular, they point to cases where an owner is dead, an owner cannot be located, or someone that is, you know, really neglecting a property. And they also would say it's a good alternative to the treasurer's sale process, which can be very lengthy and complicated and that Rich has written about at length.
Well, Rich, let me ask you, Kate just told us how she got onto the story. What attracted your attention to this issue?
Well, first of all, Kate's reporting, but second of all, in my rounds as a public sources economic development reporter, I started hearing tell of the conservatorship law being used by landlords extensively and ran into a case in which a landlord in Wilkinsburg, for instance, had filed conservatorship petitions seeking to control nine different properties, found another landlord in Wilkinsburg who had sought control via conservatorship of 16 properties, and also ran across a gentleman based in Trafford who had, under the names of six different entities, filed to take control of 63 properties located all over the county.
So is this happening in traditionally or long-term blighted areas, areas where there are abandoned buildings, abandoned homes, or is this also happening in communities that are doing well, maybe hot markets?
It seems like, based on the roughly 190 cases for which we obtained data, primarily in places that meet kind of two criteria. One is they've got a fair number of abandoned or empty properties, and number two is they're relatively near to a hot market. So, for instance, Wilkinsburg has hundreds of vacant properties, but particularly the western end of Wilkinsburg is very close to the city's hot East End markets. Those are the places that seem to be the conservatorship hotbeds.
Mm-hmm. So permitting developers or landlords to take conservatorship, is this leading to misuse of this act? Are those just aberrations? What do you think? What have you each discovered? Kate, then Rich.
You know, I think the defenders of the law would say every single case has to go before a judge. So there was certainly a lot of defenders of the law that would say this is not being misused. And in every instance, a judge is signing off on this.
Certainly, the landlords would not characterize it as misuse because in their view, they're taking a property that somebody was letting go to waste and they're converting it into presumably an occupied and maybe fixed up property. But if the law was really intended to solely attack properties that have become nuisances to the community, there are signs that it may be being used a little bit differently. The case I zoomed in on in Wilkinsburg involved a property that, yeah, it had been empty for a number of years, but the owners, also a Wilkinsburg resident, we're trying to slowly fix it up, and we're attempting to borrow money to rehab it themselves. But then a landlord who also lived in Wilkinsburg saw it and filed a conservatorship and sought to take over that property. So right now the owner, which had not who had not totally abandoned the property, is fighting off this effort to take conservatorship and take control of the property by a landlord.
Are they seeing due process or not?
The case has gone before judges. The first judge, Don Walco, who handled much of the case, retired. But before he did so, he ordered an inspection of the property to determine what its problems were and whether the current owner was taking steps to address those problems. So we'll see how that plays out in court once the inspection report is complete.
This year, we've been asking about the impact of the pandemic on just about anything, all aspects of our lives and actions throughout our community. Is there any indication that the pandemic and the resulting recession are slowing this process, whether it's in pursuit of conservatorship or in awarding of?
I don't know that COVID has at this point increased dramatically the number of vacant properties, but it certainly hasn't curbed the ambition of some landlords to build their portfolios.
And to either of you, overall, are there any questions, any concerns about the potential impact of, regarding gentrification in some areas when it comes to conservatorship of abandoned properties?
We have heard concern that properties that might otherwise go to neighborhood groups through the tax sale process are being grabbed up by landlords through the conservatorship process, whereas those neighborhood groups might take those properties and raise some money via different different mechanisms, low-income housing tax credits, whatever, and turn those properties into affordable housing, which could still serve the existing residents of the neighborhood. The landlords don't have that much incentive to do that. If they can get the property debt-free via conservatorship and promptly convert it into market-rate units, they're going to take whoever is willing to pay that rent.
Mm-hmm. And Kate, from your earlier reporting on the issue, was gentrification a concern in those particular cases?
The concern was just that, yes, the law was being taken advantage of by an outside group and not a, traditional neighborhood CDC or neighborhood advocacy group.
WESA reporter Kate Giammarisi, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And public source reporter Rich Lord, thanks for joining us, Rich.
Appreciate you having me, Kevin.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Tom Hurley, Isabel Schmaler, Lara Satsui, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.